So how many of you are investment registered where you now have to comply with the fiduciary standard for an IRA rollover, a 401k, a qualified plan? You're learning the process, aren't you? And you're trying to figure out what does it mean, because it creates a burden on your part that after the fact, a client's attorney can challenge you for what you did, how you came up with the recommendation you came up with. Did you compare the fees? Did you compare to all available products that could solve the problem? And why did you settle on the one you settled on? And what are they looking particularly at? What is the bias of the federal government as they initiate this fiduciary standard process?
Rollovers.
They're interested in rollovers. What do they think that we are most interested in?
Compensation.
So what happens is we have to establish a process. I have three buttons only, and I will figure out the correct one here shortly. So a fiduciary level suitability review is required before an advisor makes investment recommendations for IRAs and qualified plans. The fiduciary standard requires that an advisor provide advice matched to the client's needs and preferences rather than to the advisor's best interest. Compensation should not bias the recommendation. Now, it's really hard to get to that point of view because the best product may carry the highest compensation. I mean, that's a possible outcome, isn't it? But in court, and if FINRA reviews you, the bias is you probably selected that product because it gave you the best compensation. So what the fiduciary standard is about is overcoming that, and I'm going to take you through it, and then I want to apply it to the world of insurance. Now, here's something that most people don't think about. Life insurance cannot be held as an asset in an IRA, so it doesn't really apply there. But it can be held as a funding asset for a 401k or a pension plan. And if you intend to include life insurance in a 401k plan or a defined benefit plan, you have to put the life insurance policy through the same suitability process that you would the other investments that are available to the client. So suddenly life insurance is qualified, even if it's sold under what's called the best interest contract exception. That's called a BIC, a B-I-C. So what the FINRA has reluctantly accepted, I'm sorry, the Department of Labor has reluctantly accepted, is that there are some times when a commission-based product is the best solution. What is consumed a no-conflict, no-presumed conflict of interest way of handling a client's money? Can you tell me?
Fees.
A fee-based compensation schedule, so SEI, Brinker Capital, City National, Rockdale, anything where the advisor charges a fee where there's no entrance charge to the client to come into the product, there's no exit charge to leave, the advisor is compensated by fees during the period of time that they manage those assets, that's considered a presumed no conflict of interest. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because if I hold a life insurance policy in a 401k for 30 years, which is going to have the lowest total cost to the client? A front-loaded 55% whole life first-year commission with a trail that tapers off, or an asset-based charge that's there for the life of the policy, which has the least impact on the client. Oftentimes, it's the commission-based product. So the rule does allow for a BIC exception, but you have to be able to establish why that's what you're choosing to use. I would ask this question, and that's what this class is about. Should the same level of care and advice apply to life insurance that is not owned in a 401k or pension? So what you're going to see is that my thing that will save you, and why those of you who work under the fiduciary standard should not be frightened, I don't believe. The fiduciary standard is process-based. What it is asking you to do is to establish a process that will acknowledge that there are conflicts of interest between you and your client. It's presumed in an ethical framework that we have knowledge that our clients do not have. And that puts us at an advantage to direct their decisions at our discretion. If I'm building a new home, do I have the same knowledge that an architect has? Can I tell if he's putting the 2x4s close enough together? Can I make sure that the contractor is putting the electrical inside the proper shielding so that it doesn't start a fire. I am at a disadvantage relative to an architect, aren't I? How many of you are at a disadvantage? Well, what this presumes is that our clients are at a relative disadvantage to us. And so we have to make sure that we are operating in their best interest. And with that in mind, what we need to come up with is, how do I come up with the best recommendation to the client based on their assessed needs, goals, desires, and means, particularly if I'm a New York Life agent and it's June 27th and I'm trying to qualify for counsel, or I'm at Penn Mutual or Mass Mutual and it's December 24th and I want to qualify for sales conference. Our industry creates temptations, doesn't it? And that's what it's called, is a moral temptation. When we want to cause a client to take an act when much of the motivation is for our own benefit. And this is what a process should eliminate. So, process-based, what does that mean? The fiduciary standard does not presume to know what the best advice for a given client is in a given situation. So if you become audited by FINRA, and if life insurance is part of the sale, or if you want to operate under this standard outside of the fiduciary standard, they're not going to come in and say, oh, you shouldn't have sold this guy an annuity. You should have sold him a mutual fund. FINRA will not make that decision. Do you understand that? What will they say? What will they ask? How did you come to the recommendation of an annuity as opposed to a mutual fund or a managed account? And how did you come to the recommendation of this specific annuity relative to all the other annuities that are available in the marketplace? And that's where you can get in trouble if you cannot demonstrate a repeatable process that will show that. So I was sitting next to one of my good friends earlier, and he said, I guess I have to run this new thing called a, and I figured out the context and said a Morningstar report. So Morningstar has a process that you put it through, and it will come up with a recommendation based on products available. That's what this is. I'm going to show you a slide that's better at this, but as I went through about 40 hours of training on the fiduciary standard, it says the process needs to involve an element of discovery. What is discovery? Fact-finding. And where does the phrase discovery come from? We borrowed it from someone else. We borrowed it from the legal profession. It's discovering all the relevant facts and circumstances that will impinge on this decision. We then have to show a process of analysis where we look through all the facts we've discovered. We then need to sort those things into what are the problems to be solved, what are the potential solutions that are available to solve those problems, and then we make a recommendation. The only requirement is we need to make the recommendation without regard to the advisor's compensation. So here's the solutions that are available. If you're under supervision of a broker-dealer, they'll have a set of products that are available on your platform. They will give you some method to compare those one to another. And the idea is that you should then make the decision. Now, the broker-dealer at my firm has made it that if anybody wants to put an annuity on our product, it will have a 5% commission that will go into the grid, and then it has a trail. And if Prudential wants to be on our platform, they have to produce a product that matches that compensation. If Penn Mutual wants to be on the grid or on the platform, they have to do the same. So what happens is that it used to be that we were better off to sell a Penn Mutual annuity because it counted towards sales conference. Don't do that anymore, because they pull that out to say that we're going to recommend whatever product is best for the client, and then the place that we get paid for is in implementation. Nothing takes away the fact that very few clients act without outside help. And that's where we earn our compensation. And then finally, periodic review. So the fiduciary standard is process-based. It does offer a presumption of no conflict for fee-based products. It does recognize that a commission-based product may be suitable if it meets the best interest of the client exception. This recommendation should be rigorously documented to show that other options were considered and why this is best. It is presumed that the commission is fair and reasonable compared to other similar contracts in the market. A lot of advisors who do not have strong supervision are going to rely very heavily on this BIC. They're going to say, well, I sold the annuity because it's got a guaranteed lifetime withdrawal benefit, and I like that. Why'd you sell this one as opposed to that one? Well, because I understand this one. I mean, we can't understand all of them. That would be unrealistic, isn't it? Technology is going to play an increasing role in our world because there are tools now that will compare all products on a platform against each other. One that I work with gives a green light suggestion, a yellow light, or a red light, and it says these products have a green light. It's created by the broker-dealer, and so once you put the client's facts and circumstances in, it will tell you the products that are going to pass. You can then show that later if you're audited or if you're sued. The fiduciary standard does not presume to know the best advice. Rather, it requires a well-documented process. We talked about that. Oh, I'm going the wrong way. So here's what it looks like. I am not going to read all of this. But what it shows is that if we have a qualified plan to IRA rollover, you need to complete a risk tolerance questionnaire, run a Morningstar, Investnet, TPAM, or other approved RTQ, that's an automated tool, analyze a rollover by comparing existing retirement plan investment solutions, expenses and services versus the recommended IRA account. So if I left, which I have, part of my IRA money at New York Life, what is their fee structure like as opposed to me rolling it to an IRA? What do you think? It's lower because, bless her heart, New York Life pays all the fees associated with the plan so that the plan operates essentially fee-free. What product am I going to sell them that matches that? It's going to be hard, isn't it? But if I'm in a person who has absolutely no pension money and all I have for a guaranteed lifetime income is Social Security, might it make sense to pay some fees in order to acquire a variable annuity with a guaranteed lifetime withdrawal benefit so that I know that Marcel and I would never run out of money? Is that fair? So fees are part of it, but fees aren't all of it. Then the third step in the process is that I have to be able to demonstrate why the suggestions are fair, and then I need to document it. And this is the part that has to change in our world. So after 39 years, I've been mostly a trainer in my career. I've worked in two home offices. I've worked with clients. I had a complaint filed against me by a client last year, first time. Hurt my feelings, scared me. It was on a real estate investment trust. And the client asserted that he had not been properly told what the fee structure of it was or the risk. Well, so I don't know how many of you have had claims, but what do you have to do when a claim is filed or when a complaint is lodged? You have to notify your home office. You have to notify your E&O carrier. So I notified them. Well, happily, I had kept a very detailed file on this. I had documented that I had met with the client four times prior to his purchase of a product. The one that scared me the most was I knew that I delivered him a prospectus, but did I have evidence of that? Sure enough, 4 days before he bought, there was an email with all the prospectuses. I was not flippant. How many of you say, well, if you want to fall asleep, Rod, you might want to read this prospectus? Don't ever be stupid like that, okay? I mean, you're trying to be clever for something that's thick. In the email, I said, I encourage you to read this very, very carefully. And then I documented all the service opportunities for the previous 3 years. And so I had probably 50 emails, so I keep my notes and emails to myself. That's how I do it. Well, the long and the short is the claim was denied, and it was settled with no action taken, but it's because of the documentation. In the absence of documentation, they would have no choice but to have sided with the client. Okay, well, how would you discover a life insurance need? Discovery. Same thing, isn't it? Collect and document all relevant information about the client's financial situation, but qualitative emotions and desires and quantitative measurable assets and debts, desired financial outcomes. life insurance is more emotional than investments. Would you agree with that? What do you think? Life insurance is more of an emotional decision, so the process has to make accommodation for that. Analysis. I think it's best supported by a computer analysis to measure the client's current situation versus their desired situation. What am I talking about here? A needs analysis for survivor, some sort of a process to document for a buy-sell agreement. If I'm going to do a key employee policy, we need to have a process to define what the financial loss to the business would be if the key employee died. All of that is part of the analysis. Then we need to review all the potential life insurance product solutions that are available, use a selection process to provide green light, yellow light, red light solutions. Is this a whole life recommendation? Is this a term recommendation? Oftentimes they're both, right? Some whole life, some term. Is this a universal life situation? Is it an index universal life? Is it a guaranteed no lapse? Is it a second to die? Well, we'll look at all of that. And then you need to demonstrate and implement and then review. So fact gathering, how many, I'm just curious, and don't be embarrassed if you don't raise your hand, but how many of you do a formal fact-finding process and then you enter into some sort of a computer program? Okay, some, about 30%. How do the rest of you do it? By the way, I'm part of the rest of you. So a yellow pad, and what happens to the yellow pad? Put in the file, so you have evidence of what the questions asked and how they were answered and what the assets were. If you can get balance sheets, if it's a higher net worth client, if you can get tax returns, those are all good. Yes? Do you preserve the whiteboard then with a photo or something? Yeah. So I did a study years ago on fact-finding, and there's really sort of two approaches. One is the attorney approach where you say, here is a fact-finder. I need you to fill this out before we meet. I love it when an agent brings me one of those if I'm working on the case with them. And then you go through the questions yourself to find where the needs are. The second type of fact-finding is dynamic, and that's what I tend to do at this point in my career. I don't know what the next question should be until I get an answer to the current question. And the next question is going to follow from the answer. And so the fact-finding looks something like this. Either one is fine as long as you can demonstrate that you did it and what the results were. Now, if you're doing a survivor need, I think it's really great if you do have an output that you can leave with the client. Because one of the things that makes our product difficult to sell is it is intangible, right? I mean, at the end of the process, they start paying us $50 a month, $5,000 a month, $50,000 a month, whatever the premium is, and all they get is one little insurance policy. It's kind of nice to have something that they can put with it to support it. Well, let's look at the life insurance and the fiduciary standard. My experience in the business tells me that there are generally five types of policies, five categories. Term insurance, which includes generally annual renewable, level term periods, adjustable riders on permanent policies, policies that may include conversion options, refund of premium riders, disability riders, and so forth. Term insurance is for a specific period of time. It's a true risk-sharing product. The insurance company charges as much money as needed to pay the expected claims with no reserves for future claims beyond the guarantee period of the term. Whole life insurance policies are designed for a lifetime, obviously. What's the maturity age now? 121. And so we fund the policy. We build a reserve that is guaranteed to make sure the insurance company has enough money to pay the claim at whatever year the client dies. So the idea of the reserve is the mortality is very high in the early years when the client is young and not likely to die, and the cash value is low, and then as they pay premiums and earn interest, the cash value grows to equal the death benefit at age 121. So any point along that line, the insurance company is fully reserved to pay the claim. What is it that says that if the client cashes out the policy, they get that reserve? What is that called? Say aloud, you have it.
A
non-forfeiture option. Something that I don't forfeit if I leave the policy. I get the cash value. And of course, most whole life policies are eligible for non-guaranteed dividends and various riders. Universal life, fixed and index UL, invests the policy cash values in the general account of the insurance company, and then credits interest credits or index credits. Variable UL invests the cash.
That looks good. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
How many years has New York Life missed a dividend? How many years has Penn Mutual missed a dividend?
None.
How many have Mass Mutual missed a dividend? As far as I know, none. This is how many years? 160 years. So we say dividends are not guaranteed. And yet, of all the predictable things in the world, the financial world, probably the most predictable is that whole life policies pay a dividend. So I start out at 40,000, and the dividend can either reduce the premium or it can increase the values, right? It can increase the values. Well, if I want $1 million, how much would I pay for a guaranteed no lapse? We'd pay about 40%. So 16,000 buys the same million. It's not going to go up. The premium's never going to go down. But I will deliver the million for 60% less than the whole life premium. Now, you can argue at life expectancy, the whole life is a better value, but who knows? So what might be an example of a place where a guaranteed no lapse would be a superior solution to a whole life?
Maybe a pure legacy play.
Okay, so I want to leave $200,000 to each of my 5 children. Very good. Somebody else?
Pension max.
Pension maximization. I want to take the highest possible income from a pension plan and insure my spouse using life insurance. Well, if I can do it for $16,000 instead of $40,000, it's much easier for the math to work. Great example. Any others?
Maybe a 30-year term alternative.
Very good. Exactly right, because it gives future flexibility. Excellent. I'm thinking about special needs child, maybe with a second to die guaranteed no lapse, where I will provide care for this child as long as my wife are alive. But when we die, we want to make sure there's money to take care of that child. Cash accumulation is not the goal. And then finally, survivorship, whole life or universal life, it's a derivative of the other four. Have I pretty well caught it? Is that most of it? Okay, well, how do you decide? So let's take a look. You're going to tell me in a minute if I'm cynical. The way it often is, if the client can afford permanent, that's what they ought to buy. If they can't afford permanent, they should rent some term until they can afford permanent. If I like whole life, that's what they should buy. If I like index universal life, that's what they should buy. Every once in a while, there may be an outlier where they should buy a guaranteed no lapse UL or survivorship. Is that the way it is in the real world? Okay. Well, this is something that I think will change from this point forward. I think that the fiduciary standard is going to cause an inflection point where people have to begin to think beyond, this is what I buy, I know it works well. Is there anyone here who can make any sort of a rational argument that whole life isn't a good product? I don't know of it personally. There are some of you who would make an argument that index UL may not be, but I would argue that if it's fully funded to the minimum non-MIC face amount, so a stuff full of cash, one insurance company's, so what's the risk of an index UL compared to a whole life? Market may be flat, right? So one insurance company can demonstrate that in the 6,000 possible crediting periods of the last 30 years, if a person had bought their index UL, the average would have been 6% or higher 99% of the time. So is there really a lot of risk? Or is that a risk that people who don't like index universal life use to sell against that product without considering that maybe it has features that would be more appropriate to a client? Okay, let's keep going. It's sort of complex. So about 20 years ago, halfway through my career, I was recruited to the New York Life Home Office to work on their field technology team. And I did that for 5 years, and I really enjoyed it. part of my assignment was to work with a company called Sterling Wentworth, to build out what are called needs analysis tools. And now they've got a great one that New York Life and others uses that will look through the entire database of New York Life every night to find sales opportunities of clients that they should be made aware of. So we begin to build what were called expert systems. Expert systems to solve how much insurance you should buy was very easy. Expert systems to do disability analysis, very easy. It was simple math. And then they wanted me to help them build an expert system to recommend the best life insurance policy. That shut the place down. You're going to see why here in a minute. Because these products are so complex and there's so much overlap where one or the other would work that coming to a conclusion is extremely hard. Let's take a look at why. It's more than term or permanent. We need to match product to time horizon, to the client's risk tolerance. The greatest risk to permanent life insurance is underfunded premiums in the early policy years. That's solved with whole life, but there's a different problem for whole life policyholders. Client personality, ability to pay premiums, and a desired premium pattern. Do they want fixed or flexible premiums, lump sum or periodic premiums, short pay or lifetime pay? Primary objective for the insurance, is it a level death benefit need or an increasing death benefit need? Is there a primary emphasis on high death benefit to low premium with little regard to cash value? Or is a primary emphasis on balance funding? Or do we want to try to drive as much cash accumulation to provide later tax-free income in retirement? Are we going to consider this as an asset class to diversify a wealthy client's financial portfolio? So I've got some really good cases in the mill right now of an advisor I work with who works exclusively in investments will often bring me in to meet with his life insurance clients. So a few weeks ago, I showed him a single premium whole life. So you could take $500,000, put it into a $50,000 base whole life, assuming you have financial need. You now have created a single pay whole life policy. And after the first year, where there's about a 6% deduction to the cash value is about 6% less than the premium paid, by year two, they're equal. And from that point forward, the thing grows at about 5.5% per year. How does it grow? Tax deferred. How is the death benefit taxed? Tax free. If they have a need for chronic illness, they can accelerate the death benefit. How? Tax free. If they take money out of it, how is it taxed? Same as an annuity because it's a MAC. How many people have clients with $100,000 or more sitting in a bank CD or the equivalent? What kind of money is that? This is what I would call lazy money. I actually made a really good sale of a single premium whole life to a client once. I said, he had like $800,000 sitting in the bank. I said, you've got the laziest money I've ever seen. I said, your money is so lazy. He was LDS. I said, this is like the kid who sits out behind the seminary building smoking a cigarette while skipping class. That's how lazy your money is. It's earning 0.5% interest. And the 0.5% is subject to tax. You're in a 40% tax bracket. Relative to inflation, this money is losing value every year you hold it there. Why on earth don't you put that money to work? Okay, well, that's whole life. So is it an asset class to diversify a portfolio? Concepts. Golly. So to build this selector, we have to say, are we going to use this for be your own banker? Estate equalization is a primary objective to allow one child to inherit the business, other kids to get cash. Is it for estate liquidity, pension maximization, executive compensation, pension funding, supplemental retirement income, buy-sell agreements, key person, survivor need, charitable wealth replacement, gift amplification? Now you start counting up everything on this page and multiply them by each other. How many possibilities do you have to consider to make a good recommendation with respect to life insurance? Are you seeing why this is hard? So, I believe it has to be a multi-step process. First is to have great facts. It all comes down to the facts. For the product analysis, So you gather all the facts. Let's see, I'll think about a case. Can I share without name the one we worked on, Anthony?
Sure.
So Anthony Taylor has a great client. He owns a business. It's a very successful business. All his kids are in it. Anthony manages his retirement assets, has already done the buy-sell planning. But Anthony thought that the single premium whole life might be an interesting thing to look at. So we sorted through all the available information, and then we come down to the product analysis. So the first thing that I would do is consider in isolation each of the following suitability elements. Note that the primary product recommendation based on this isolated review. So on the previous page, what I just said is, you have to consider all of that. So once you've gathered the facts, look at the time horizon and say, which product best fits the time horizon this client's given us? It was a lifetime need, right? The second is his risk tolerance. What was it?
Low
for that part of the money. Personality. What was his personality? Driver, expressive, amiable, analytical.
Driver.
Okay, so he's pretty assertive. Ability to pay premiums and the desired premium pattern. What was the desire?
One and done.
He was tired of paying life insurance premiums. Primary objective, what was it?
He needed some death benefit.
And
tax-free he liked.
He wanted death benefit. He wanted more productivity to his money. Seemed to me that it came out to be this life insurance as an asset class. And the idea was is that this would be, I didn't put legacy on there. Wow, there's even more. Main idea is legacy. So once we put it through that, we said time horizon, whole life, no lapse UL, index UL. Risk tolerance, low. That recommends what? Whole life. Client personality, driver. Drivers are pretty comfortable with any product as long as they understand it. So that was a neutral. Ability to pay premiums, extremely high. What did he put in, 200,000? Yeah. Fixed or flexible premiums, lump sum is what he wanted. Primary objective. Each one of these came up, and 4 out of the 5 came out whole life. So just looking at them that way. So once you do that, then you look at the ones where there's a conflict between them. So the time horizon says permanent, ability to pay says term. What are you going to do? You can do this, guys. Term with a conversion option. Because you can sell very low-cost term if the insurance company is only on the hook for the period of the guarantee. It's more expensive if they want to have a conversion option. If they call 1-800-TERM, what are they going to get? The one without the conversion option, right? So that's where we come into play because we would establish that. You weigh the conflicting recommendations. You come up with a primary recommendation and a secondary. Be prepared to explain this to the client and document it in your file. Now, what happens is oftentimes in our business, and I'm speaking as a trainer for a long time, is that agents tend to be all or nothing. Apparently, they never read the book of Samuel, Solomon, where when Solomon had a problem, what did he suggest they do with the baby? Yeah, well, that wasn't a good recommendation for a baby. But is it possible that more than one policy would fit a situation? Because clients have multiple needs, don't they? So to solve the estate equalization need, they may use a survivorship, no lapse whole UL to get the lowest possible premium for estate equalization. For legacy for the grandkids, they may do a first to die guaranteed no lapse UL. For an asset diversification play, they may do a single premium whole life. It always puzzles me, how many of you are golfers? If you could only pick one club, what would it be?
Nine iron.
How many would like to go golfing with one club? Does it make sense? Why do we usually go into our insurance discussion with one or two clubs? Why do you do that? There's so many available to solve so many different problems. So once you've gone through this process, then you present those alternatives to the client and move to the implementation step. Product to time horizon, temporary needs. I'm not going to tie you down with this. But so yesterday we got Sean Hewlett and I are working with a client who's started several technology startups. Hard for me to say, easy for you. And I have no idea what he's worth, but it's a lot. He's decided that he wants to buy $1 million term policy for each of his adult children and their spouses. We've shown him permanent insurance, whole life, UL. He doesn't want to tie his money up. But he wants to cover his grandkids. So I was able to show that he wants 10-year level term for the adults. So I said, you know, if you were to put $1,000 a year into a $250,000 life insurance policy on your grandchildren, 10,000 or 1,000 times 10 is how much? $10,000, right? It was actually 1,100 each. If you put 11,000 into this policy on your 3-year-old, based on the average of the market for the last 30 years, when they reach age 65, they could take $1 million of tax-free income over the course of 30 years. $11,000, $1 million of tax-free income. That's pretty amazing, isn't it? So it's possible that you can look to longer term for children. Lifetime needs, estate liquidity, estate equalization, legacy, final expense, care for, I think these are generally no-lapse policies, maybe a whole life. You want something with a lifetime guarantee, don't you? Because these are things that you don't want to have any risk of all of the policy failing. If you're looking as a supporting asset in retirement, index universal life up to age 50, if it's funded to minimum non-MEC face amount, maximum funding, whole life is what I generally recommend above age 50, diversified retirement income sources, who knows what this last bullet is talking about. Go to the MassMutual website. They have one of the best brochures ever produced called How to Tame a Bear Market. Can you remember that? How to Tame a Bear Market. Download that brochure. Now, Penn Mutual has one built into their software. There's something called Financial Cornerstones. But the brochure works great for me. It shows a person who has $1 million in a portfolio, and they pick a period in time in which the market averaged 9% a year. They take 7% distributions, and 30 years later, the $1 million is, or I'm sorry, 15 years later, the market's down to like 300,000, the value of the account. Why? Because this market that averaged 9 had 3 bad years in a row at the beginning. They show that if you take the same thing, but you have some money in whole life, and every year that the market's down, you suspend distributions for the following year, you take money from the whole life policy. You only had to do that 3 times in a 20-year period of time. And if you do that, the value of that $1 million is $3 million instead of $300,000. So this is called a diversified retirement income source, a buffer that allows you to use a whole life to take a higher payout from a plan that uses the market. I think that's a great idea. Product risk tolerance. Averse to risk of principal or lapse of coverage, whole life or guaranteed no lapse UL, guaranteed term for temporary duration. Averse to loss of purchasing power risk, what is that? Inflation. Whole life with paid up additions, index universal life fully funded to the maximum non-MEC to force the policy into a corridor. Desire to increase productivity of savings, whole life consider single premium. Desire to increase potential return with no declines from markets, potentially index UL. Desire to supplement income in retirement, index UL. Recommend permanent policies with an overloan protection benefit rider. What is this about? So for 30 years of my 40-year career, I had a real problem with using policy loans as a source of supplemental income, because what's the risk? People borrow the money. They trigger an overloan, which is when the loan equals the surrender value. Now they can not only not take any more loans, what else happens? They have to start paying money out of taxes or the thing lapses. This can sometimes be $1 million or more, 1099, with no cash value to pay the tax. Some policies have an overloan protection rider that will freeze the policy when it reaches that point, freeze the cash value, freeze the loan, and we'll make it a reduced paid-up policy. So consider that. desire to have tax refunds for chronic or terminal illness, any permanent policy is really good for that. I'm going to go through this sort of fast, just sort of take a look at this. Drivers value control. They love whole life as part of a portfolio, but they will consider any of those if they understand them. Expresses value flexibility, IUL and VUL. Amiable desires reliability and guarantees, whole life or guaranteed universal life. Analyticals desire predictability. So that's just sort of my process when I'm thinking about it and trying to match it. Premium pattern, well, obviously. So let me tell you a story here. So I told you my experience with UL. I started in the business in 1978. Whole life was the only permanent product available. We had endowments, but didn't sell them. Universal life came out about 1984. Interest rates were very high, so most agents funded them pretty low, because 14%, you know, that's as close to magic as you're ever going to get, to watch something compound at 14% tax-free. Well, what happened? Interest rates dropped steadily for 10 years, and those ULs were now underfunded. So my brother Keith was working in Oakland, California. His wife had a job, and she was quitting. Well, they offered to let them convert their term insurance to a universal life policy. It was like a $100,000 policy, and it was guaranteed issue. So Keith called me and he said, hey, this looks pretty good. Should I do this? What was my experience with UL? It was bad. Well, the problem is that people underfund them. They can get in trouble. With whole life, you have a lot more predictability. Well, Keith really sort of pushed me because he liked this UL, but I was strong enough that I convinced him to buy the whole life. So he did. He gave it up. In the next 3 months, he got cancer. Now, it went into remission. It was fine. But 3 months later, he lost his job. He was out of work for 2 years. If he'd have bought the index universal life, we could have kept that thing going. The whole life was gone. He lost all the insurance. Now, if he'd have been in the whole life for 3 years, would he have been okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd have loan value, you'd have dividends. The point is it isn't as easy as you think it is, because sometimes flexibility is really important. Okay. Well, you can consider all of that. And if you want to copy this, I'm happy to do it. This is the way that I think. This is my experience in the business. So I looked at each of the concepts, and I have sort of an idea as to why I would recommend one policy over another. My point isn't that I should make those decisions for you or your clients. My point is that you should have a process so that when you encounter a different situation, you know how to come up to a recommendation that you can explain and that you can feel justified in doing. It's great to sell with conviction and personal experience, but to the degree that the client's needs and personalities are different than yours, perhaps you need to evaluate the process you use to make those recommendations. Well, in conclusion, these are the high-level categories that have to be considered to give what I believe to be a suitable recommendation for life insurance. You need to have a process to demonstrate it. And are there any questions? We've got 2 minutes. Yeah.
So I'm not exactly sure how to phrase this, but you, with your golf analogy and taking 11, 12 clubs are out, what if you decide you're only going to play one hole instead of the entire course, and you're going to be extremely proficient bring an expertise to that one hole?
Sure. So I can understand, and it was more successful in the past than it will be in the future. So I am an expert in funeral policies. And I just go out and I say, I'm going to look at one need that you have, and I'm going to solve that need perfectly. I'm going to solve one need, term insurance, so that's what I sell. To the degree that society moves towards a fiduciary approach, where you need to know all the facts and circumstances of a client, I think that will become more difficult. But there's nothing wrong with it. And we're not there with life insurance outside of a pension plan yet, so you can certainly make that an area of expertise. But I'll tell you a quick last story, I promise, and then we'll be done. I was at a meeting, an industry meeting, where a financial planner had held himself out to be a financial planner. He had planned for life insurance needs, he's done investment planning, retirement planning. This was for a couple in Chicago. They had something like a net worth of $3 million. They were in a car accident. Both of them needed long-term care that lasted for more than 5 years. The advisor had not dealt with long-term care. It bankrupted the estate. They sued the advisor because the way he held himself out was that he did comprehensive planning when he didn't. So if you're the guy who says, I'm going to focus on one thing only, just be sure that you don't call yourself a planner. Hold yourself out so that the service you provide is absolutely consistent with what you can deliver. Okay, we're good. So, glad to be here. Ask me any questions you got afterwards.